Coming up on New York Now, the State Assembly approves legislation that could allow Congress to obtain President Trump's state tax returns.
Secrecy in government breeds corruption. Only through independent oversight and thorough independent oversight can we protect integrity in government.
And there's a changing of the guard in the state's Republican Party.
My mission and goal is to get us to the point where a Republican occupies the second floor of the state capitol. And that will be our mission critical.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Additional funding provided by the Leo Cox Beach Philanthropic Foundation. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Farm workers win a key legal victory that clears the way for union organizing.
We'll discuss that with Josefa Velasquez of The City and Rachel Silberstein of the Times Union at the Reporters Roundtable. That's going to happen after our look at headlines.
Mr. Speaker, this bill is the first of a package of two bills that together provide a mechanism for New York State's Department of Taxation and Finance to facilitate requests from congressional tax committees in terms of providing access to the tax returns of New York elected officials, top appointed officials, and the entities that they are significant owners of or that they control.
The subject of Donald Trump's tax returns continues to make news here in New York. This week, the State Assembly okayed a bill that would allow Congress to get the returns if requested, giving authorization to the state's tax department to release them to three congressional committees. You'll remember the state Senate passed the same legislation earlier this month, which means it now goes to the governor's desk. Let's listen in to lawmakers on the floor as the bill was being debated.
Just to convey the timeliness of this, when it's being communicated that this is for political purposes, allow me just to remind us of the substance of the matter. Just on yesterday, it came out publicly of a 10-page memo that IRS staff conveyed, quote, "The law does not allow the Secretary, in that instance of Treasury, to exercise discretion in disclosing information provided that statutory conditions are met," end quote. This has nothing to do with politics. It's about conflict of interest that we may not be aware of. Furthermore, the memo actually indicated that there were several clear examples that there could have been illegal behavior that occurred by the person that's been referenced here. The notion that we should not be moving forward because of feelings or sentiment or party, when it is clear and obvious that the IRS is indicating exactly what we are saying around transparency should occur, does not make any sense at all.
Secrecy in government breeds corruption. Only through independent oversight and thorough independent oversight can we protect integrity in government. These are extraordinary times, Mr. Speaker. Today, the President has spurned the tradition of releasing his own tax returns, and he has intentionally and publicly thwarted the legitimate and necessary oversight of Congress. Today, he's hiding his tax returns. Tomorrow, it could be the tax returns of the other multimillionaires who populate high federal executive branch offices today. Congress must be able to do its job. Congress must guarantee that the IRS is not giving favored treatment to any of its bosses, including the President. Congress must guarantee that no public official is selling government policy for personal gain. Congress has always had access to tax returns as one tool to make these guarantees reality.
I find this bill today and the bill we took up yesterday to be incredibly disturbing, and I'd like to echo the comments made by my colleagues. The fact that clearly we're using this legislative body as a weapon against an individual that we may disagree with today and set precedent that we can go after our political enemies through these, whether it be taxes or treating individuals differently if they are associated with the president or not associated with the president for the same crimes. That was yesterday's bill. I find it very troubling.
One of the no votes came from a Democrat, the Bronx's Michael Benedetto.
Make no mistake, I have complete disdain with what is going on in this administration in Washington. But when I see a couple of bills coming to us, which the purpose is obvious, is political in nature, then it gives me pause. We are traveling down a path that we should not be traveling down. No legislature should craft legislation for political reasons just to get a few people they consider their enemies.
The assembly this week also passed what Democrats in both chambers are calling the double jeopardy loophole. It will allow state prosecutors to try individuals who have been pardoned of federal crimes by President Trump. This is a bill previously passed by the Senate. It too now awaits the governor's signature. The other big news of the week involves a change of leadership in the state's Republican Party. Erie County Chairman Nick Langworthy secured enough support among the county chairs to beat out Ed Cox, who has been the head of the party for the last decade. They met with the press on Tuesday in Albany.
It's an exciting time. I think we are going to show a renewed fighting spirit in a Republican Party here as we move forward after this reorganization. I'm very excited about working with our legislative team. You know, obviously, we had a tremendous setback in 2018, and it's time for us to rebuild, retool, and revitalize the Republican Party across the state of New York and having a 62-county strategy to do that. We lost this majority in one election. I think we can gain this majority back in one election. I look forward to working with Leader Flanagan and the team over at the Capitol to get the ball rolling on capturing that majority and recruiting the right candidates to go take those seats back in the Senate. And I've had tremendous partnership and the greatest admiration for our Assembly Minority Leader, Brian Kolb. And we're going to increase our ranks in that state assembly. But, you know, beyond 2020, you know, my mission and goal is to get us to the point where a Republican occupies the second floor of the state capitol. And that will be our mission critical to put the infrastructure in place across this state.
Langworthy was asked what needs to happen for Republicans to be a force again in a statewide race, something they haven't won since 2002.
Our greatest challenge as a party is enrollment, and we need to register new voters. We are going to tackle the issue of voter registration in the state of New York. There's so many things that have to be done as a minority party in enrollment in a state that it's the one that easily gets set behind. We are going to go across this country and find the best practices on voter registration and bring them to the state of New York. It has to be done. We're going to close this gap, and it's something that's going to take everyone's help to do.
Ed Cox now moves over to the president's 2020 finance team.
I am somehow attracted to the presidential elections. My first one was my father-in-law's President Nixon's in the 60s, and that was the greatest comeback ever. My last one was with candidate Trump, and that was the greatest upset ever. I look forward to the president's reelection in 2020, which I think is going to be a realignment election.
In other news, residents and legislators from the Long Island City area rallied at the Capitol this week to highlight legislation they say will transform the state's approach to economic development. It's the region that was supposed to get the second Amazon headquarters before the company unexpectedly canceled the plan this winter.
No matter if you were for or against the specific project in Long Island City, we can all agree that the process stunk. And the process was not considered enough of the people who already live in these communities or the effect these economic development policies have on the people of the state of New York as opposed to the benefits they are providing to these wealthy corporations. So what should we do? We should make sure that that is considered in the process. I am going to be introducing legislation to require a social impact assessment. We already require environmental impact assessments when developments are proposed. Why should we not also consider the effect on residents of a community? Make sure that we consider the effect on the existing housing stock, the displacement that might occur, the effect on infrastructure, which may already be stressed. And that if a project is putting too much of a burden on those things, we should either change the parameters of what's proposed or reject the project entirely. That was entirely missing in this proposal in Long Island City. When Amazon came to town, they made a deal in secret. There was no consideration of the local community. There was no consideration of the effect on the subway system or the sewage system or the schools in the neighborhood. Everyone was rushing to give a lot of money to a company that didn't really need it, when we should have been thinking about what the effect would be on the local community. So we are going to propose requiring that for developments, for proposals of major economic development projects, that a social impact assessment be done to make sure that local communities are protected when big projects come to town.
Also this week, the Sexual Harassment Working Group released a legislative agenda ahead of Friday's second hearing on the issue. It includes eliminating the severe or pervasive standard and amending the state's constitution.
The truth is that some employers have gotten away with murder, pulling bra straps, rubbing lubricant on people's arms, or suggesting that somebody gets breast implants has not been considered offensive behavior. This is crazy. We must update our harassment laws in New York, and we must do this now. As Rita mentioned, we must update the severe or pervasive standard that is applied to sexual harassment cases by our courts and agencies that are responsible for administering these matters. This standard hasn't been updated since it was created in 1986. It's been over 30 years, and it's time to change the standard now. Our society has evolved, and conduct that may have been appropriate or acceptable in 1986 is not appropriate in 2019. Also, because some judges have vastly different ideas about what constitutes severe or pervasive, individuals have gotten away with horrific conduct.
And finally,
this state tax exemption would serve as a well-deserved thank you to the men and women who give freely of themselves to keep our communities safe. The legislation would also be a powerful recruitment tool to help boost our depleted volunteer EMS roles and fire department roles.
Senator Jim Seward joined Assembly Republicans in calling for a full income tax exemption for qualifying volunteer firefighters and EMS personnel. It's a move, they say, to help give incentive for current volunteers to stay and to draw in new people to help keep numbers up in communities, particularly those in rural areas. To be eligible, among other things, a volunteer must be in good standing, completed all state-mandated training courses, and have completed a minimum of 1 year of service. And that leads us to this week's New York Now poll question. Would you like to see an income tax exemption given to qualifying volunteer firefighters and EMS providers? Let us know at nynow.org. Let's look at the results from last week's question. Should undocumented immigrants be allowed to obtain a driver's license? This one was close. 52% said no. Tim in Corning, watching us on WSKG, is an emphatic no, saying absolutely not. They should be removed from the country, period. Barbara in Rochester told us undocumented individuals are illegal persons in this country. Illegals should not receive any benefits of U.S. citizenship, such as driver's licenses. John in the Capital Region is on the other side of the issue. We need to wake up to the status of our dreamers and get them integrated into the U.S. society, and especially into New York. And Matthew on Facebook wrote, wouldn't getting a license make them documented and easier for law enforcement to find and identify? Thanks so much for responding. Remember, you can always do so at nynow.org. It's where you can find all of our past programs, plus links to us on social media, including Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. There's a pathway to the Capital Confidential blog as well,
It's also available at timesunion.com. And that's it for me. We're going to send it on over to Casey Seiler now for the rest of the program. He heads up our Reporters Roundtable.
All right, thanks, Matt. And now for some analysis of the week's news, I'm happy to be joined at the Reporters Roundtable by Rachel Silverstein from my own paper, The Times Union, and Josefa Velasquez from The City. All right, big news on the labor front, big win for farm workers due to a decision in the Appellate Division, Third Department, overturning a lower court decision that concludes that farm workers do in fact have the right to organize, to collectively bargain, which is something that for, about 90 years now has been denied to farm workers.
Yeah, it's a big win. I mean, they can still appeal, of course, but the governor's against them. The AG chose not to defend the law in this case.
Against the Farm Bureau.
Against the Farm Bureau. Right, so yeah. The Farm Bureau is just on their own on an island fighting this thing. And it's a huge win, and it was just this arbitrary law that said farm workers cannot organize because just on the off chance that they would strike during crop season, which is a very small season in New York. It's a short season.
Yeah.
And this all stems from a 1938 law that basically said all employees in New York can unionize, collectively bargain, and organize except for farm workers, like Rachel said. And this is a momentous occasion for farm workers in New York, considering how many of them are here. A lot of them are immigrants, and now they have the chance to start unionizing and start organizing. Of course, the Farm Bureau said that they're going to appeal this decision to the state's highest court. But this also adds increased pressure to the legislature, which is solidly Democratic for the first time in decades, to now codify this decision into law, giving farm workers overtime pay and a day of rest and letting them have access to workers' comp, which is a big deal for thousands and thousands of immigrants that are working here.
It's amazing that among the things that they will now be, or that they could be guaranteed if in fact that's codified, legislation that has been floating since as long as I've been covering the Capitol, which is a decade now, includes things like a guaranteed day off, which is something that, I think hopefully we all take for granted. Guaranteed overtime pay, that type of thing. The argument from the Farm Bureau, in addition to the point you raised, that a strike during picking season could just wipe out an employee, labor groups come back and they say, you can bargain a contract that says you can't strike during picking season.
Yeah, there's plenty of civil workers, emergency workers, who have written into their contracts, criteria for when you can strike or if you can strike. Of course, there's the Taylor Law.
Right. The point that labor groups also make is that, in addition to being able to bargain for those rights, the projected cost increase in food and agricultural costs that the Farm Bureau warns against, that could be an argument made against all kinds of labor organizing. Right.
Right. The Farm Bureau says that just the overtime provision would cost farms throughout New York over $300 million a year. And they're warning that because if the legislature were to pass this bill, which is the Farm Workers Fair Labor Act, that then New Yorkers would be getting their food from either outside of New York or even outside of the country.
Right.
But the same argument could be made out of every bill that passes through the legislature, that it's going to cost money and cannibalize an industry. But unless it actually passes and happens, it's all speculation at this point.
Moving on, speaking of outside of New York, we saw passage of a second bill this week that seems less aimed at what's going on in New York than it is aimed at Washington, D.C. And that was a bill that is now headed to the governor's desk that will allow certain congressional committees, if they make a request for state tax records as part of a legitimate legislative purpose, they will be able to get those records. And that, of course, seems designed by Democrats to open up the New York state tax records of one Donald J. Trump.
Absolutely. It's a highly specific piece of legislation, and I think on the floor we saw it drew pushback from Republicans and even a couple Democrats who said, we shouldn't sort of weaponize legislation this way.
It's really funny to me that Congress couldn't do this, like national politicians couldn't do this, and the New York legislature has opened the door to seeing Donald Trump's taxes, which have been under scrutiny ever since he started running for president. And the New York Times has done this excellent piece, like piecing together what is in them and whether or not he is, you know, whether or not he is a billionaire as he tries to claim. But it's also highly political now that New York is solidly blue in all forms of government. It could be weaponized against the legislature and some of the members that have voted for it.
This comes at the heels of the passage of another piece of legislation that would amend, that would tweak the state's double jeopardy laws to make state prosecutions of those close to the president who have received a pardon for federal crimes, they would still conceivably face any state charges related to those
same
matters.
We should just call it the Michael Cohen law.
Yeah, right, exactly. The Michael Cohen law, potentially the Paul Manafort law, what have you. So let's move on. Another New York City personage is Bill de Blasio. We are now a little bit more than a week into his presidential campaign. How's he doing?
That's a loaded question.
It's a simple one.
Been traveling to Iowa and South Carolina a lot. I think the argument being that he wants to at least shore up some support in some of these key battleground states. In South Carolina, I think he's trying to come after the black vote down there. I mean, his wife is black and his children are too. And that is a solid constituency he's had throughout his mayoralty. But a Q poll or a Quinnipiac poll found that his favorability rates are pretty low. It's only 8%. And then it's split between people that don't know him or people that just flat out don't like him.
The leftover 92% is split almost evenly between people
right.
who have an unfavorable impression of him yes. or do not know him. That is not good.
Yeah, and I don't know that that necessarily speaks well to what he's trying to do, but what does he have to lose? He's a lame duck mayor. New York City doesn't love him. The state government doesn't love him. The governor doesn't love him. So why not just go and spread your wings and try to run for president?
Speaking of which, you know, here in Albany, we're dealing with housing regulations.
Right.
And he's been noticeably absent as they're sort of debating overhauling New York City's housing regulations. If I recall correctly, he's always been kind of, he hasn't really been an enemy of real estate. He's been pretty cozy with them in mm-hmm. the past, but you know he's been delegating his city council speaker to kind of do a lot of the discussions up here. And I think he, you know, doesn't need any more enemies like real estate.
We've got about 3 weeks to go before those rent regs expire, as they are known to do usually in years after elections. So is there an expectation that there are going to be significant changes, or is it just going to be a straightforward re-up since we have Democratic control of both houses?
It seems to me that the legislature really wants to overhaul some of these rent reforms, which is eliminating these landlord allowances that let landlords make upgrades to buildings and apartments that then get sent over to tenants to pay after a long time, to pay after, you know, a few months, and that gets baked into their rent. But to your point about de Blasio not being here, in 2015, he was super involved. This is the last time that rent regulations were up for renewal. He was really involved, and this year, he's sort of not been present at any point. And that is huge, especially now that he's running for president and he might need real estate's backing. But there's also this national conversation of affordable housing and tenants' rights that are happening throughout the country. It's not just in New York, it's happening in California where there's an affordable housing crisis and a homelessness issue. So it might be smart for him to start trying to insert himself into the dialogue a bit more.
All right. There's time running out for that. There's also time running out for the potential legalization of adult use recreational marijuana. How's that going, Rachel?
Not well.
Yeah.
It seemed like it was dead in the budget. Some, you know, Crystal Preeple Stokes, the assemblywoman from Buffalo, is trying to revive it and create just a comprehensive, take another stab at it. But like we've seen in states all over the country, it's very difficult to do legislatively. The states that have legalized it have done it through a referendum, which is much cleaner. The public just votes on a proposal, yes or no. And when you do it legislatively, all these interest groups come out, and it's very difficult to reconcile everybody's conflicting needs.
So chances that it's going to get done before the end of the session?
They'll do something. I think they'll do it incrementally. They'll either do Diane Savino's expansion of medical marijuana or maybe regulate hemp products. In Vermont, they just allowed people to grow at home but didn't commercialize it. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll take in more an incremental approach.
Very quickly, we heard the announcement on Tuesday at the monthly meeting of the Joint Commission on Public Ethics that Seth Agata, the executive director, the top staffer there, a former Cuomo administration lawyer, is going to be leaving that post next month. So does anybody want to predict that a national search for a new executive director for the state's top ethics watchdog will result in somebody who is not a former lawyer for Andrew Cuomo?
It'll be a former lawyer for Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
I think there's a pretty good chance.
All right. That's the smart money, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much to Rachel Silberstein of the Times Union and Josefa Velasquez of The City. You can read her outstanding stories as well as many more at thecity.nyc. And that's all the time we have this week. For Matt and everybody here at WMHT, thanks very much for watching New York Now.